This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. The ocean covers 70% of our planet. It's home to an estimated half of all life on Earth and essential to everyone. Yet much of the ocean remains unmapped and relatively unexplored. For obvious reasons, it's difficult and expensive to do science under miles of water. That's not to say we don't know anything about the deep ocean, though. To the contrary, scientists have made incredible progress in the past 40 years, in large part due to technological advances in robotics, as well as photography, genetics, and any number of other fields. Now, a new book tells the story of modern deep ocean exploration in a way that everyone from veteran ocean scientists to the most uninitiated readers can enjoy. The book is Discovering the Deep, a photographic atlas of the sea floor and ocean crust. The authors are five ocean scientists from different fields of study and institutions across the country. Joining me now in our Woods Hole studio is Jeff Carson, professor of geology in the Department of Earth Sciences at Syracuse University and a fellow of the Geological Society of America. Also Deborah Kelly, professor in the School of Oceanography at University of Washington and associate director of science for the first U.S. high-power, high-bandwidth cabled underwater observatory. And finally, Tim Shank, an associate scientist in the biology department at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and director of the Oceanographic's Ocean Exploration Institute. Welcome to all of you.
Great to be here.
Hi there.
Now, we should say you guys also had two other co-authors on this book. Dan Fornari is a marine geologist and senior scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, and Michael Perfit is professor of geological sciences at the University of Florida. Five of you all working together on this. How long did it take to put this book together?
Well, that's a good question. I think if we look back at the oldest documents we have, it goes back to almost 10 years to when we signed a contract with Cambridge University Press. And it went in fits and starts, but most of the work got done just in the last couple of years.
That's a patient publisher.
They were very patient with us, and we just kept putting them off and worrying that they were going to just, you know, one day just tell us to get lost. But and we had faith in the project and each other, and we were able to get it done.
When I started looking through this book, I have to say I couldn't decide whether I was looking at the most informative coffee table book ever or the most beautiful textbook ever. Which one were you going for?
Yes.
All of the above.
Yeah, there was a lot of back and forth discussion among the co-authors about exactly how to create this book and between those two extremes. And I think we're someplace in between. And that you're not sure which one it is means we've succeeded in doing that. So we wanted to make it a very visual document that showed all of these features that really people would only see at scientific meetings or in scientific journals, put them all together in one place. And yet we also wanted it to be something that would be informative and usable as a class.
Deborah Kelly, you kind of span geology and biology. Tim, you're a biologist. How do you span in one book everything from the structural geology of the bottom of the ocean to all of the life that lives there?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I didn't start out as an author on the book. They brought me in later when we now know that the mid-ocean ridge system is a really dynamic place, and it's a place where you have superheated fluids that take metals and things out of the rock, and those metals out of the rock and other properties come out and are nutrients for life. So when they started doing this geological atlas of the world, they soon realized that there is this continuum, if you will, of information from the rock to the water that's interacting with the rock that produces chemical environment there in the deep ocean, and in that chemical environment is a menu of nutrients for life. And so they're so well connected, they said, hey, let's get a biologist in this project. And so I'm so grateful to be a part of it.
Where did all the imagery in this book come from? Are these all images and data that the five of you generated and put together, or are you pulling from the whole field of oceanography?
We had both. So a lot of it, we've all been involved in various exploration programs around the world's globes, with oceans, mid-ocean ridge systems, underwater volcanoes, and also on land. And so we pooled with new technology. We're getting fantastic imagery that probably in the book, I bet at least 90%, nobody's ever seen before. It's never been public information. And so we pooled images that we had on our different exploration cruises, discovery cruises, and then the community was incredibly generous with their images. So we were grateful to them too.
Jeff, we've all heard statistic that 70% of the planet is covered by the ocean. But there's a rather shocking version of that in the beginning of the book, that more than 50% of the planet is covered by what's called abyssal plains. What does that look like?
It's pretty much the most boring part of the planet. The bottom of the ocean is just looks kind of like a golf course covered with snow. It's smooth cover of mud. That mud's made up of tiny little shells of organisms that lived up in the lighted part of the ocean, the shallow waters, that lived and died and then settled down like dust on the bottom of the ocean. And it's just a smooth, rolling, you know, remarkably boring and flat part of our planet. But underneath that is this vast plain of volcanic material that was produced at the mid-ocean ridges. And really, that's the focus of the book, how you make that volcanic foundation and the material underneath it.
Tim, are those abyssal plains as dead as they sound,
yeah,
or is there life there?
Yeah, Jeff just made it sound like there's nothing there. It's a desert.
geologically.
Flat feature, fine. But as soon as you take a sample of that flat feature, that sediments that are down there, you're going to find a great diversity of life. Lots of worms and other crustaceans and other things are there that are just we're now just trying to understand how that diversity is distributed around the world's abyssal plains. And it's not a simple relationship. We now know that when the upper water column productivity changes, let's say a change of 15% in terms of the growth of animal life that lives up in the water column, will change the benthic community, the bottom community in that abyssal plain, by 60% of the species will change. So there's it's a big deal. We're talking about 5,000 meters down, so several miles down. If you go to 6,000 meters and deeper, that's 45% of our depth of our ocean. So there's a lot below that. Most of this book really is between, let's say, 1,000 meters and 4,000 meters is where we're covering in this book.
Now, so there's 50% of the planet that's covered by the abyssal plains, these huge expanses of mud. But then there's these mid-ocean ridges where actually most of the volcanic activity on the whole planet is taking place. So Deborah, tell us a little bit about those areas.
Sure. They're amazing places, and we're starting to, with new technology and submersibles, ROVs, we're getting a much better picture, new mapping techniques where we can actually map the seafloor at centimeter resolution. And they're incredibly dynamic. So we see places that are in the Mid-Atlantic Ridge that are much deeper than the Grand Canyon, lots of faulting, lots of earthquake activity, to places that look more like Hawaii or Iceland, except maybe a mile or two down, and where there's volcanism going on all the time on our planet, but underwater, but most people we're hardly ever there in the right place at the right time to see it. So one of the, I think, phenomenal discoveries is this really amazing connection in the absence of light between volcanoes and the life that lives there. So it's always a very exciting place to dive on and explore.
I mean, this is quite possibly where the first life on the planet arose.
Absolutely. I think most scientists now believe that that's true. And there's many societal as well as scientific reasons why these places are so important to keep looking at. And so NASA, for example, is using these hot springs on the seafloor as guides for exploration for life in other places in the solar system now.
Now, you use the word hot springs. I'm familiar with the term hydrothermal vents. Are they one and the same, just a less technical version, or is there some differentiation there?
No, they're the same. So on land, we would call them hot springs usually, but we use them interchangeably, from hydrothermal vents to hot springs. But the big difference is because of pressure on the seafloor, that in mid-ocean ridges, the fluids can get 700, 750 degrees Fahrenheit, and actually emit boiling fluids on the seafloor.
When we're on land and we think about, you know, the animals or the plants that live in, say, Oklahoma versus New Hampshire, there's no surprise that they're very different. But then we talk about these huge expanses of abyssal plain, and somehow it seems like that should all be the same, and the same thing with these mid-ocean ridges. How different is it from place to place? You were starting to touch on this, Tim, a little bit earlier, that the differences you see in the biology from place to place in the ocean.
Yeah, they are remarkable. It is a vast expanse of global ocean we're talking about. This is like seams on a baseball, this mid-ocean ridge going through around the globe. And so you may think that, and it's all connected by the medium of deep sea water, so why wouldn't everything just sort of be the same? But it's somewhat similar to having, you know, koala bears in Australia, kangaroos in Australia. We see different fauna around the world in different places. So the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, for example, is dominated by shrimp, massive swarms of shrimp that don't exist in the Pacific. And the Pacific is giant tube worms that, that thrive at hydrothermal vents there. And it's different again when you go over to the Western Pacific off Japan. We see large conglomerations of snails, massive, large snails. So, and there's a whole field of study looking at this, biogeography and the patterns of evolution in our deep ocean. And so the species, while they're somewhat similar in their family level, let's say, they're sort of, you know, it's like people. We're all one species, Homo sapiens, but we have, you know, Japanese and we have, you know, Russians. We have, you know, different lineages, if you will, that grow out. Like dogs are all one species too, right? In the deep ocean, we see similarities like that. There's shrimp in almost every vent site in the world, but they're usually a different species at every single vent site. And we believe that these fracture zones on the seafloor are giant barriers to their dispersal and their connectivity to different sites around the world.
So is it just a matter of distance, or is it something innately different about each of these sites creating these different communities?
No, that's a great question. Sometimes we feel like it is distance, and sometimes we feel like it could be the chemistry of the fluids is different, and certain animals can't tolerate, certain species can't tolerate certain chemical environments, or the heat's too much in certain places. There's also if you see in the book, that there's these eruptive dynamics that happen on different mid-ocean ridges. So the ones in the Pacific will erupt more frequently than ones in the Atlantic, for example. And we feel like that has some control on what animal life could actually live there and flourish there. Those animals that are pre-adapted, if you will, to colonize a place rapidly after an eruption, grow quickly, become mature, reproduce, put the gametes out in the water, and colonize on the vent site are going to live in the Pacific.
Where it's erupting more frequently.
Exactly. So you have to meet your environment and be well adapted. And I think we see different adaptations in different species that just fit so well into the region where they're living. So we haven't figured out this puzzle yet. There's an evolutionary puzzle to what lives on mid-ocean ridges, and we just haven't figured it out yet.
Well, and Jeff, as Tim was just alluding to, the geology in these places is not all the same either. Again, on land, we wouldn't be at all surprised to think about the fact that the Appalachian Mountains are different than the Rocky Mountains or different than the Himalayas. And yet, how much do we even know about how similar or different these mountain ranges underneath the ocean are?
Yeah, well, that's a real contrast between the continents and the oceans geologically. On our planet, the continents are old areas that are formed by the production of mountain belts that result when the continents sort of bang into one another over geologic time. The seafloor, on the other hand, the oceanic crust, is manufactured at these mid-ocean ridges. It moves laterally, conveyor belt-wise, across the oceans, and eventually gets stuffed down underneath the edges of the continents and sort of recycled back into the earth. In that way, the oceans are sort of continuously repaved. They're all sort of manufactured under the same conditions, so they have kind of a uniform geology that we don't see on the continents. And this is really interesting for a number of different reasons. It means we think look at the seafloor in just a few places and then extrapolate over these huge areas of the seafloor. That's something you just can't do in the continents.
This is really where a huge proportion of the Earth's crust is being made. This is a really fundamental planetary process. And yet, you guys even actually say it's essential to life on Earth. How well do we understand it? I mean, it's buried under thousands of feet, miles of water. And these mid-ocean ridges were only discovered 60 years ago.
Right. These processes are still very new to geologists. I mean, modern geology has been being done on mountain belts for 150, 200 years, something like that. And certainly the same physical principles all apply to the processes going on at mid-ocean ridges, but with some interesting variations on those themes. It's interesting to notice that, you know, we see volcanoes on land or earthquakes in the Himalayas just in the last week or so. And those we're sort of familiar with. But in fact, most of the volcanic activity and most of the faulting on our planet is all happening underwater, a lot of it along those mid-ocean ridges. And so, yeah, as you say, it's absolutely a fundamental planetary process, building new planetary real estate at these mid-ocean ridge spreading centers.
And yet we have better maps of Mars. Why?
Well, that's a good question. it's hard to study the seafloor under a couple miles of water. Water's a tremendous barrier. And in the book, there's a wonderful chapter on the technology that's used to get us down there, to get geologists and biologists to the seafloor where they can, you know, apply what we know about from on land science to those special circumstances. Yeah, it's a bit unusual, you might say, that we know more about other planets, parts of other planets, than we do about the bottom of the ocean. Our investigation has been incredibly focused along these mid-ocean ridge spreading centers, and yet, you know, we've only seen a tiny percentage of those areas.
How much of it is just the technological challenge, and how much of it is a need for funding? Because, of course, inherent in this contrast with maps on Mars is the fact that billions of dollars are being poured into creating spacecraft to go explore our solar system.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, NASA's got a wonderful funding machine, and NASA investigations have captured the interest and enthusiasm of the public. Everyone supports that. And yeah, I think sometimes we lose track of what's right in our own backyard, you might say.
I'm talking with Jeff Carson, Deborah Kelly, and Tim Shank about their book, also co-authored with Michael Perfit and Daniel Fornari, called Discovering the Deep. We'll talk more in just a moment. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with three of the five authors of Discovering the Deep, a photographic atlas of the sea floor and ocean crust. In studio with me, Jeff Carson, Deborah Kelly, and Tim Shank. Jeff, early in the book, you write that a geologist's dream would be to drain the ocean. Why?
Well, it all has to do with the water that covers most of the seafloor. And that, you know, that is a dream. And it's one thing that's discussed quite often every time you go to sea. I know the first time I went to sea, the chief scientist on the cruise announced that, oh, well, here we are at the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. And I was somewhat disappointed to see there's nothing but water out there. And we you know, you want to understand what that mountain range looks like. You want to bring your experience as a geologist, for example, in my case, to looking at the shape of the terrain and the way the rock, specific rock types fit into that that context. And you just can't do that from the surface very well. And I have to say that the technology has leapt forward very, very rapidly, largely thanks to advances made right here at Woods Hole. And we can now do almost everything on the seafloor that we could do on land in terms of studying and sampling the rock materials, mapping the details, the shape of the seafloor, and so forth. The thing that's really missing is being able to sort of see that mountain vista to get the kind of view you might have of the Grand Canyon. You just can't see that far. It's totally dark on the bottom of the ocean. You have to take your lights with you, and they only penetrate a short distance.
So nobody's ever seen the mid-ocean ridge as a mountain range the way we might look from the base of a mountain up at a whole mountain range.
No, that's correct. I mean, only to the extent that we can create bathymetric maps that are just like the topographic maps you might use for hiking. You can visualize the shape of the topography from that. But no, you can't. You don't get that postcard view that you might have of the Tetons or the Alps or the Himalayas.
Deb, you are working right now with this high-power, high-bandwidth, underwater cabled observatory. Explain what that phrase means and what you're trying to get out of this observing system.
Sure. So this is a 15-year effort in the making. It's funded by the National Science Foundation. The name of the whole project is called the Ocean Observatories Initiative. And our part that we're working on is a cabled observatory, which is off the coast of Oregon. And it basically is to, for the first time, bring in high power and using telecommunication cables out to places that we really don't have 24/7 presence in. So one of the main areas we're working on is an underwater volcano about a little over 300 miles off the Oregon coast. It's the largest volcano off the coast. It's an incredibly active volcano. It's erupted twice recently. And so the idea is that we're bringing in seismometers, trying to understand, I call it the heartbeat of the volcano. These things are, it had 8,000 earthquakes in 24 hours when it was erupting, the first starting to erupt. And so what's nice about it is we can bring high-definition cameras, underwater mass spectrometers, a lot of these technology things that people would normally think of in a high-end lab, we can now put on the seafloor. And all those data come in at the speed of light, and we have two-way communication and all the power that we need, so we can keep all these instruments going. And the idea is to look at process linkages. So when melt migrates into the volcano, the seafloor actually expands upward. And so we can monitor that, and we can look at the earthquakes. And Over this one 24-hour period, there were 8,000 earthquakes, and the seafloor fell 7 feet in that same time period. And so what's really amazing is it brings all the interdisciplinary science together, and that's why we chose the instruments that we did. And the other thing that's really will change how we interact with our planet is none of the data are proprietary. So anyone in the world, students of all ages, can log on when the cyber infrastructure part of the program is finished in June and have access to this amazing data set that, and really do citizen science.
7 feet. I'm still stuck on this number. 7 feet in one earthquake. Do earthquakes and volcanoes happen on a different scale in the ocean than they do on land?
No, I think so that there were 8,000 earthquakes, and what that monitors, it's you could think of Iceland or Hawaii, and when the melt is migrating into the volcano, the seafloor eventually, you can think of a big holding tank of, in this case, 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit melt, underwater lava, right, or underground lava, and it keeps building up pressure, and then as the roof of the magma chamber, the holding tank, cracks, that cracking event when lots of melt is injected beneath the seafloor and onto the surface, all those little cracks create earthquakes. These are 2 magnitude or less. So one of the discoveries is these are earthquakes that are so small that they can't be picked up on land on terrestrial seismic systems. So we're seeing new insights into how these volcanoes work.
And do volcanoes underwater actually erupt the same way that they would on land?
Absolutely. In some cases, yes. They don't contain as many gases, and they're under pressure. So the eruptions are not as volatile-rich. We don't see huge explosions unless they're very shallow. And so most mid-ocean ridges will see lavas that look like what you would see on Iceland or Hawaii come out, these bulbous-shaped or sheet flows. So in that way, they're similar, but they're not really as explosive as what you'd see on land.
Now, Tim, talking about how technology has changed, we've seen a real explosion, and we've talked with you about this before on the show, in technologies that allow scientists and also the general public to basically ride along as you've got some robot vehicle down in the ocean looking at these worms and snails and shrimp and whatever else is on these hydrothermal vents. And we can be sitting at home watching this on video. How much has that changed your science?
Well, when you think about it, we really have, with our submersible technologies like Alvin and Jason, the remotely operated vehicles, we only get a few hours at the bottom. As a biologist, we don't even get to like step outside the vehicle and touch the animals you study, right? We get very little time to understand. Imagine if you could only see the trees and plants in your backyard for a couple of hours. Once a year, gather the samples up. You might sample your tree and bring it back, and then look at it.
And only see them through like a little pinhole window.
A 6-inch porthole. So it's a bit frustrating. So these ocean observing systems can give us much more time. Could be a total game changer for the biology to actually see how seasons might change on the deep sea floor, how animals actually do what they do. They interact with other animals, how they find their prey, how they reproduce. I mean, it opens up all the ecologies for life in the deep ocean, these ocean observing systems. You're mentioning something where we can have 24-hour type presence on the seafloor with looking at using telepresence. That is vehicles on the seafloor that are connected to the surface ship, and then that beams up, the video signals beam up to the satellite and come down into your office, your lab, your computer, and you can do that. And so you can in real time follow along and make the discoveries with scientists. The public can watch these things. There are several outlets for that now. And I think it creates a tremendous awareness for everyone. It's been a game changer over the last couple of years doing this, because when we come across something on the seafloor, because we tend to be very specialists in our fields, that when we see something, even a sea star or a giant worm or something, we can call an expert immediately and tell them to get on their computer, look at it. What do you think it is? What is it doing? And we have generated more collaborations this way, more projects this way. We've gotten so much more value out of the science we want to do because we have that communication and that telepresence in real time. So it's been a tremendous boon. But to go along with that, we have to have the samples to actually have them in hand to study their cells, their DNA, all the aspects of an organism. And so we have to have sampling. We have to have more time on the bottom through these ocean observing systems and telepresence to educate the public.
Jeff, let's go back to the book, because as fascinating as the evolution of technology is, that's really only the first chapter of the book. And then the rest of the book is actually structured according to different types of geologies. And I'll tell you, I love the names in geology. I find them fascinating and beautiful, but I have no idea what they mean. So go through and explain what some of these different geological types are that we see in the ocean.
Okay, well, the organization of the book is really a vertical tour down through the seafloor from the surface, where we see the hydrothermal vents and lavas that were erupted right on the seafloor, down into the rocks that formed underneath those volcanic features. And, yeah, geology has its own language that's all geology students have to learn as they go along. So I'll try to avoid using too many of those specific rock names and features. And we seem to have a special one for everything. But yeah, as we go down, we see the material that formed immediately underneath the lavas, for example, what we call a sheeted dike complex, which is, you know, really one of the most bizarre rock units and very distinctive of oceanic crust. It's formed, if you can imagine this, it sort of looks like books on a shelf, where you have these tabular structures that are all lined up side by side. Hmm. And each one of these represents a crack that's opened up and filled with magma, liquid rock. Each one is a record of one small amount of seafloor spreading, that is, the divergence between lithosphere plates. And beneath that is the reservoir where that magma comes from, the coarse-grained rocks. They're coarse-grained because they have the crystals have time to grow down in the magma chambers that Debbie mentioned just a moment ago. And beneath that, then, is the Earth's mantle. And those rocks that underlie all of the Earth's crust are very rarely exposed on the surface of the Earth. We see them in some places on the ocean where there are giant fault zones, for example. And those rocks have sort of had the magma wrung out of them that erupts on the seafloor and that builds the rest of that suite of rocks that makes the oceanic crust. So all of these rocks are related, and they all kind of fit together. And one of the nice parts about the book is that while you can read about the details of any of those parts in many different scientific journals and other reports, this is a place where you find them all in context. You see the relationships between them. And we also talk about the processes that we can infer from looking at the rocks.
As you're just referring to, putting together this book, the geology, the chemistry, the biology across the whole ocean is a huge effort to pull together a lot of very different science. And I imagine, in addition to perhaps gaining a big picture, this probably prompted some exciting new questions for you. What kinds of research questions might have come out of actually putting this book together?
Yeah, that was a particularly exciting aspect of the book for me, and I think for all of us. Really seeing the holes in our existing matrix of information. I think one of the things that I became very aware of was that our information on the seafloor just comes from a few areas that were not necessarily all that representative of the bottom of the ocean. For example, to see the deeper levels of rocks in the ocean, we have to go to these places where there are big fault zones. Well, it's not clear that those big fault zones are in areas that are typical of the rest of the seafloor. So we're having to sort of extrapolate and interpolate across huge areas there. And so for me, one of the real frontier areas is to try to find a way to look at the seafloor between these areas where we already have information to really validate our idea of interpolating and extrapolating between them.
Deborah Kelly, how about you? What kinds of questions really came to the forefront as you were putting this book together?
I think for me, really understanding a couple areas. One is the linkages of volcanoes and life. And we have, you know, pretty good maps now, sometimes exceptional maps of the seafloor, but we're really missing temporal scales right now. How do things evolve? We know chimneys can fall over. They can grow 10 meters, so 30 feet in a day, or sometimes in a day. Some of them last for 150,000 years, and we're just starting to gain insights into that from, you know, day changes, hourly, second changes to what happens over 150,000 years. How do microbes inside of these chimneys, you can think of them as almost living rocks. They're filled, insides are filled with microbes, and yet we don't even know the right scale to sample them at. And once these systems evolve, say, during an eruption, falling eruption, how does the life change with those? Also, working through the book, we walk through many of the key vent systems along the spreading centers. And for me, the questions, when you put all that together and all the images, some of the best images ever of individual vent systems, even though in many cases the rocks look the same, the tectonic setting looks the same, these vent systems look very, very different individually. And so why does that occur? There must be some process linkages, feedback mechanisms that we don't quite understand yet. So a lot of avenues for discovery still.
Talking about how things evolve over time, mountains on land, of course, are subject to a lot of weathering. Do we see those kinds of processes in the ocean? Could currents, I guess, going past them essentially weather these mid-ocean ridges?
Tim's an expert in looking at the impact of topography where there's very large mountains, and we see very strong currents that kind of like on the top of a mountain where you'll see very strong winds at the top of the mountain, and you see the same thing on these big mountains, and it impacts the biology there. And Tim can certainly talk about that. But the weathering in many of these areas, because there's large faulting, the seawater itself does weather the rocks over time, but it's a very slow process. But in these areas where there's lots of faulting, we'll see big landslides and it's big scree slopes like you'd see on a mountain range. So there is that kind of weathering where you'd see big boulders. And
yeah, what I think is interesting is as Deb mentioned, the temporal scale that we really don't know. But, you know, in the course of taking you on this tour of hydrothermal vents around the Royal's Mid-Ocean Ridges in this book, it was clear to me as we look at the catalog of species that live there. You know, we go and we sample, we go back and look at them and see if they're new or not. And we've discovered over 700 species in the past 35 years. That's an average of discovering one every 10 days during
wow.
that time. There's no lack of discovery down there, but Deb's right. I mean, why do we see different animals in different places on the Mid-Ocean Ridge? You know, the chemistries of the vents are mostly similar. The rock tops can be similar. Why is that? And I think there's an evolutionary answer here, is that the ocean basins have had a regional history of species that have lived there, you know, as vents were first forming in our oceans a long time ago. So, I mean, there's many questions there to ask as to why we see certain species in different places, and we're not really sure. That's a preeminent question in my mind. And it takes this kind of a survey, a comprehensive survey of the global Mid-Ocean Ridge system, to see that the chemistries really are kind of the same. Interestingly enough, I guess it was over 10 years now, an event site called the Lost City in the Atlantic was discovered in about 800 meters of water, and it had a completely different kind of system. And the fauna that lived there are fundamentally different. The microbes that live there are fundamentally different. We only know of one Lost City in our deep ocean. And it changed the way we thought about vents probably forever. And so this was and we just haven't found – we haven't really gone exploring yet for another one. We really should, because the more we learn, the more we feel like we need to go explore more. Because every time we find something new, find another vent site, we find new species, like I just mentioned, and which have different ecologies, different adaptations, and tell us a little bit more about how life can exist in these places.
It's Tim Shank, also in the studio with me, Deborah Kelly, and Jeff Carson. We will talk more about their book, Discovering the Deep, and definitely this Lost City, in just a moment when Living Lab continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking today with three of the five authors of Discovering the Deep, a photographic atlas of the sea floor and ocean crust. In the studio with me today, Jeff Carson, Deborah Kelly, and Tim Shank. Tim, before the break, you were mentioning this really unique site, the Lost City. Deborah Kelly, Jeff Carson, you guys are the experts here on this. What makes the Lost City so unique, and where did that name come from?
So this was a life-changing discovery for both of us, I think. And Lost City is in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. It's on a very large mountain about the size of Mount Rainier, if you grew up in the Northwest like I did, so 14,000 feet tall. It's a very steep mountain, and one of the reasons we initially went there was because it has a very different stratigraphy. So instead of having the lavas and the dikes and gabbros that Jeff just mentioned, this is formed by very long-lived faulting on the seafloor, so over a million years of faulting that has basically stripped off all the upper levels of the ocean crust. And what we're left with is the source rocks for most melt in the ocean, called mantle rocks. And because of that, these mantle rocks have a little bit different chemistry than the gabbros, the magma chamber rocks, or the lavas. And so as seawater migrates down in these mantle rocks, it undergoes reactions with the rocks, and it forms these incredibly very novel fluid chemistries. So they're unlike the chemistries we would see in black smokers. These the fluids coming out of Lost City are about 200 degrees Fahrenheit, and they're, imagine organisms living in 200 degree fluids that have properties like liquid Drano. So liquid Drano has the measure of acidity is pH, and liquid Drano has a pH of 12, and Lost City has a pH of 11. So these wow. microbes have figured out how to develop metabolisms over time that use methane and hydrogen basically as their energy food source. And so we've been looking at these we started out looking at 1,000-year evolution, which is, there's no place in the world's oceans where we've been able to look at microbes over that time period, and they fundamentally change over that. These rocks are, we call it Lost City because it was found completely by chance. We were looking at the mountain because these, we call them massifs or core complexes, and they have a very different, very specific kind of morphology and structure. And the Atlantis Massif, where we're working on the Woods Hole ship called Atlantis using Alvin, it had the type characteristics of these mountains. And so the south face of it is cut by a very, very large fault. So imagine cutting a volcano in half, and you could look in the inside of this and try wow. and understand all the different alteration processes and faulting processes that they made this mountain what it is.
What is it like to go down in Alvin, presumably with some idea of what you're diving on, but to arrive at the bottom of the ocean and find something completely and totally new that no one else has ever seen or even imagined could be possible, like looking at a volcano that's been cut in half?
Right. So this this was, to this day, Jeff and I, was probably one of our most, if not the most amazing dive we ever had. And remember, we didn't even have a map of this place. So you're in a small sphere about 6 feet across. Imagine driving around in mountains in a Volkswagen Bug with three people and a flashlight and no map, right? And it's cold and dark, and you really don't know. You can reach a little bit in front of you with a sonar, but you really don't know what's there. And so one of the, and these features are, we did a lot of work on black smokers, and you see a lot of metals, and they're characterized by big plumes. They look like jets of black particle-rich fluids coming out of the seafloor. These structures, immediately we knew, were completely different. The vents are still the largest vents ever discovered. They reach 180 feet above the seafloor. They're bright white. They look like cave deposits, stalagmites or stalactites. And one of the coolest things at the end of the dive, we only had about 4 or 5 hours on the bottom because we were driving around a lot and ran out of battery power. So at the very end of the dive, we were just by chance at the largest structure called Poseidon. And we said, okay, let's start at the top and just float our way down to the bottom. We kept going and going and going. And to this day, it turned out to be the largest structure discovered. So it's pretty incredible.
Jeff, you're over here smiling, thinking about this dive, too. I mean, that's got to be absolutely incredible. When you start to head for the surface, is there a thought that you might be the only ones? I mean, how many people are going to make it back there and get to repeat that dive and see that again?
Our minds are just completely blown by the experience, of course. And like Debbie said, it was just, you know, starting at the top of a building and going down in the elevator and, okay, a couple of floors down, okay, it's pretty big. And, you know, next thing you know, you've gone down the equivalent of, you know, 10 stories or something like that. And it's just almost unbelievable, like nothing that had been reported from the seafloor before. And on the way back up to the surface, you know, it's interesting, in the submarine, it's usually an hour to an hour and a half ride back to the surface. And usually you're wrung out from a describing the features you see down there, making collections, taking notes and things like that. And usually you just want to take a nap or something like that. But, you know, we were just so jazzed, so excited about this, realizing that, you know, really it was a special moment where we'd seen something that no one's seen before. We had enough samples, and we're going to be able to document this. And fortunately, Debbie was along, who really had a lot of experience with black smoker hydrothermal vents and just, you know, had the right perspective to bring this to the public, I think. And but again, it was a place where we're also very aware, as Debbie and Tim have mentioned, where just this interaction between the rocks, the fluids, and the biology that characterized Mid-Ocean Ridge processes that, you know, just really made it exciting. So
I'm not sure how long after the dive it was, but Deb called me from the ship and said what they had discovered and had sent me a picture of the Lost City vents. And it's not unlike what you might see on the cover of the book. It's a Lost City picture. And I said, she went on and on about how great this place was. And I said, Deb, there's no animals. I don't see any giant tube worms or mussels or clams. This looks like it's totally boring biologically. Well, we did get another expedition to go out with Alvin and explore Lost City more and take samples for biology. And it turns out the diversity of Lost City is as high or higher than any other vent site in the Mid-Atlantic. And it's just that they're very small. They live in the cracks and crevices of the carbonate rock that forms those giant structures. So there's more polychaete worms and snails and all kinds of little crustaceans and things running around in there.
How do you get close enough to even see that?
Well, no, you got to bring the sample up on board and you got to look under a microscope.
So you actually break a piece of this formation off and bring it up with you?
Absolutely. Yeah. Put a little box and bring it up.
You used an underwater vacuum cleaner, basically.
That's right. We did. We suctioned things off, too, with a vacuum cleaner off the sides of these things.
I mean, this book must hold who knows how many stories like this, that each one of them is an incredibly exciting event and discovery. And then to think that we've only mapped about, 5%? Of the seafloor, and you're talking about the fact that we're extrapolating from such a small sample size. Could there be hundreds of other lost cities out there and we just don't know?
Absolutely. I think, you know, the potential for in the next decade for very profound discoveries is huge, and I teach a lot of undergrads, and that's one of the things I try and share with them, that, you know, when I was growing up, I thought, oh, all the discoveries have been made, how could you ever do that? And in fact, you know, the oceans are our last frontier and so there are in many interfaces, from pharmaceuticals, from the sea to volcanism to, you know, metal deposits, animals, life itself, mm-hmm. It's ripe for really amazing discoveries. So
this is in so many ways, a very young science. We've been studying physics and astronomy for thousands of years. Ocean science, maybe hundreds of years, really. And then to, you know, only have discovered mid-ocean ridges really 60 years ago. We're catching up so quickly with the technology. But how far behind are we? And is there something fundamentally different when you go at this pace in the early stages of a science? We're not going to spend hundreds or thousands of years, you know, slowly exploring and documenting everything. It's like going at warp speed from the time you first discover something. Does that change how we understand it fundamentally?
Yeah, I think it does. I think it's, well, we're able to build upon our experience on land, for example, to look at those types of things. But, you know, there's tremendous excitement in the post-Sputnik era with the National Science Foundation's support and other agencies. We've been able to go very rapidly. On the other hand, I think, you know, I think all of us have the feeling that pace of discovery and exploration and exploitation of some of these areas has really slowed down recently. The discovery of the Lost City, that was in 2000, and we have not mounted a cruise to go back and look at for more of these types of settings, even though we suspect that they could be very widely distributed on the seafloor. So that's, you know, I'm afraid that's a sign that we're just maybe losing focus, or maybe we've just gotten a little too blasé about some of these discoveries. But there's tremendous resources, information on biological diversity, and information on how other processes on land operate that we can obtain on the seafloor. And we really need to be advancing in those areas much more rapidly.
Do you see signs when you are on the bottom of the ocean, in these most remote parts of the ocean, is there any sign of human impact there?
Yeah, that's actually kind of a sad issue, I think. I mean, even out in areas where you're far from shipping lanes, you know, you go to the bottom of the ocean on the mid-ocean ridges, and sometimes you see litter, basically. You know, paint cans. I once saw a high heel, calf length, black leather boot. You know, And, you know,
you can't help but laugh, but it's not really funny.
No, it's not. But yet there's, I think that's important. We can't treat the oceans as just this vast landfill. We need to understand that it's a finite resource and that we need to be able to take care of it.
This book, in addition to being the book itself, you have created a whole host of teaching tools to go along with it. So talk a little bit about the extra resources.
Yeah, Heather, we've, for each chapter, which is image-rich and figure-rich, we have put together a PowerPoint presentations, basically, that you can download off the web. So you can go and with each one of those comes the a caption description of what you're seeing in that figure or that image. And we've done that so that people can take them right away and use them for lectures and educational purposes. We've also got a series of videos that are also online for people to look, and so you can see how things are actually moving at a temporal scale and not just a snapshot. So we've provided a lot of resources like that, and it's information rich, I think. Those captions and the credits, you can go to who actually took the photograph and talk to them more about it and explore deeper.
Not to play the skeptic, but in this digital age, you're starting from a lot of data and digital images. Why put it in book form?
Well, I think students, for example, learn in all different sorts of ways. In fact, I think most of us, I mean, there's been a big interest in developing MOOCs, massive online classes, for example, where students learn entirely online and see nothing but digital information. But in fact, I think we've all come to recognize that students want a book and they want to have that sort of blended approach to having a hard copy as well as being able to explore deeper, as Tim suggested, and go off in their own directions to some extent. But, you know, I think most of us still love the physical presence of a book in our hands, and whether it's even on a reading device, I think we want to be able to hold something while we're looking at it that way.
Yeah, I think this is a nice merger of the two. So students can certainly go online and see the images and get that information. But to me, it's still, you know, I remember as a kid, and I think maybe this is one of the reasons why people don't, the ocean isn't in their mind as much as anybody in the world can walk outdoors and at night and see the stars. But most people don't get access to the ocean. And so this book has tried to take them to the seafloor and see those stars on the seafloor, those unique places. And having that physical presence in your hands of seeing images that you know maybe one or two people in the world have ever seen before is to me, it's a much more engaging process that you go through. My brain works very differently.
I was given a Jacques Cousteau huge coffee table book when I was about 12 years old, and can absolutely tell you it was a huge inspiration for me. Still have it on my shelf, and this is another amazing book. Congratulations to all of you. And how can people get hold of this book?
This book's available from Cambridge University Press, or you can order it online.
All right. Well, Deborah Kelly, Tim Shank, Jeff Carson, thank you very much. Also, congratulations to your co-authors, Mike Perfit and Dan Fornari. And thank you all for being here.
Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Until next week, this is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.